Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your Sun Sounds volunteer reader, presenting the major news articles from the Monday, July 27th, 2026 edition of Tucson's Arizona Daily Star. Before we begin with the headline articles, let's check out what kind of weather is in store for us. Today's weather: sunshine and a few afternoon clouds. A stray shower or a thunderstorm is possible, highs to 104 degrees Fahrenheit, winds west-northwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight's weather is cloudy skies early, followed by partial clearing. A stray shower or thunderstorm is possible, lows to 79 degrees Fahrenheit, winds south at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow's forecast predicts sun and a few passing clouds, highs to 102 degrees Fahrenheit, winds west-northwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. And now from the front page of the Arizona Daily Star, the first article is titled, Trump Challenges Rules for Detaining Migrant Children. This article was written by Sonia Sharp of the Los Angeles Times. Dateline Los Angeles. For more than a quarter century, a lawsuit settlement from a case brought in Los Angeles federal court has dictated conditions for children held in immigration detention. But now, the long-standing settlement, which set minimum standards for housing, education, and medical care for migrant kids in federal custody, while strictly limiting how long they can remain there, hangs in a balance in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals after a challenge by the Trump administration. At the same time, the federal judge in L.A. who presides over the agreement appears poised to appoint a powerful new enforcer to uphold it. President Donald Trump has long sought to scrap the Flores settlement, which dates back to the Clinton era. In recent months, the Trump administration has waged a legal battle to cancel the agreement, while also pleading with the district court not to order an independent monitor to boost its compliance. Florence is the only thing standing between them and indefinite detention of families, said Lichia Welch, chief legal director at Children's Rights, a plaintiff in the case. Last month, Assistant Attorney General Brett A. Shumate pressed the Ninth Circuit Court to give the administration the thumbs up or thumbs down on its bid to tear up the settlement and end what he called judicial micromanagement of federal immigration policy. The Flores consent decree is an agreement which goes well above the constitutional floor, Shumate told the court during oral arguments in June. We're asking that the Department of Homeland Security's compliance with the law be assessed based on the law, not a 30-year-old settlement agreement. The three-judge panel sharply questioned the Justice Department's legal claims, saying, little had changed since the government last petitioned the court to have the agreement dissolved in 2020, a request that was rejected. The judges also pressed Trump administration lawyers to respond to evidence from scores of declarations filed in district court since last summer in which detainees describe struggling to sleep in freezing, brightly lit rooms, vomiting from eating spoiled food, and begging for diapers, baby formula, and asthma inhalers. You've said a lot of reasons you're doing this is to discourage families from coming in the first place, so you're basically punishing children because their parents brought them here, Judge Marcia S. Berzin said. Berzin, a Clinton appointee who issued a fiery dissent last year in the case that challenged the administration's use of armed troops in immigration enforcement operations, asked, you're saying there's no constitutional problem there? I understand the detention of children at the border is a controversial policy issue, but that's a policy decision, Shumate said. Just a day earlier, Chief U.S. District Judge Dolly M. Gee scolded a pair of government attorneys from her bench in Los Angeles, signaling she would probably appoint a new special master to force compliance with the settlement agreement. We're talking about 11 years of this, Gee said during the June 1 status conference. None of these issues are new to me. These are all issues on which I have issued orders. I'm very displeased about the fact that my orders are being disregarded and are not being complied with, not in good faith. Both sides seem to be operating in different planes of reality, G said. The disputed settlement emerged from a 1985 lawsuit over the fate of 15-year-old Jenny Flores, a Salvadoran refugee who was picked up by federal immigration enforcement and left to languish in detention in Pasadena. At the time, there was little awareness that children were among the tens of thousands of migrants fleeing civil war and state collapse in Central America. with virtually no U.S. government infrastructure to protect them. It was a surprise, said Benjamin Roth, a professor at the University of South Carolina College of Social Work and an expert on the agreement. There was no thought that there were kids in this mix. The current court fight centers on Immigration Detention Center in Dilley, Texas, run by the private prison company CoreCivic, where the vast majority of children and families in immigration custody are held. In court filings earlier this month, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement said it has maintained Core Flores-related services at Dilley and argued its length of stay numbers were skewed by a small number of families it was forced to keep because they are considered national security risks. U.S. Customs and Border Protection likewise boasted its July 1st report shows our highest level of compliance to date. Immigrant rights advocates called those claims a fiction. We see the same sorts of problems and concerns and misery that we've been seeing for the last 15 months, said Welch, the children's rights attorney. In dozens of declarations collected as part of the court records, detainees recounted broccoli full of worms, diapers doled out one at a time, and staff tearing up children's drawings. One mother said medical staff left off her 8-year-old's broken arm. Another said she was denied treatment for hepatitis B, even after doctors told her she could develop liver cancer and pass the infection on to her unborn daughter. Still others described unexplained rashes, outbreaks of diarrhea, and infestations of lice, among a host of other maladies for which many said they were offered only Tylenol or allergy medication. Even Christmas brought misery in the form of an ICE agent dressed up as Santa, who shoved children away trying to hug him, according to the detainees' declarations submitted to the court. What happened on Christmas Day can only be described as an atrocity, one mother called. Children dropped everything, ran up to him, begged for candy, and wanted to take pictures. Some children even cried and begged him for their freedom. Santa himself acted very indifferent. The Department of Justice argued that immigration kids could still sue over poor conditions if the Flores settlement is unbound, but experts say existing protections would collapse without the legal architecture of the consent decree to support them. Under the settlement, the federal government has built out a very efficient system to provide temporary care for kids, Roth said. If Flores is dissolved, it's not going to be easy to stand up the same set of programs. If the Trump administration loses before the Ninth Circuit, the fight over Flores could soon escalate to the Supreme Court. I'd be shocked if the Ninth Circuit rules for the government, and I'd be shocked if the Trump administration doesn't appeal, said Eric J. Siegel, a law professor at Georgia State University and an expert on the High Court. But consent decrees are legally and politically complicated, and the treatment of migrant children further tangles the situation. Given the legal and political complexity, the Supreme Court could rule to keep the settlement in place or decline to take the case at all, experts say. It's more likely than not the court would stay away from this, Siegel said. For now, both the district judge and the Ninth Circuit panel appear fed up. I think my patience has come to an end, G said, during the recent hearing in her Los Angeles courtroom. The next front page article is titled, GOP Fights Ballot Voucher Warning. This article was written by Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services, Dateline Phoenix. Top Republican lawmakers are trying to block voters from being told that if they approve Proposition 145, a ballot measure billed as protecting voucher funds for children from military families, they actually would kill another measure aimed at a broader reforms of empowerment scholarship accounts. In a new lawsuit, House Speaker Steve Montenegro and Senate President Warren Peterson contend that the language that Democratic Attorney General Chris Mayes has approved to appear on the actual ballots to explain the ballot is the measure is skewed in a way to convince people to vote against it. That's because the verbiage crafted by Mayes tells voters that if they approve Proposition 145, it will entirely nullify any other law approved by voters, even at the same election that affects the voucher funds. And that would void all of Proposition 121, or rather 212, the Protect Education Accountability Act, and not just the parts about military families, but the entire package of limits on how voucher dollars could be spent and even an income cap on eligibility. But even as they were adopting it, supporters of Proposition 145 made it clear they not only knew the effect of Proposition 212, but publicly acknowledged that it was designed to kill it, even if voters approve it in November. Yet the new lawsuit seeks to deny that information to voters. Central to all this has been the effort by Republicans to block a public vote on Proposition 212 and its list of changes ranging from who can get vouchers and how the money can be spent. At one point, Montenegro sought a deal with the Arizona Education Association, offering to kill another GOP ballot measure aimed at unionizing, or rather union organizing, if voucher foes would abandon their initiative. That fell through, so Republicans crafted Proposition 145 to put provision in the Arizona Constitution to override any future ballot measure that would allow the state to sweep voucher funds that military families were not using for K-12 education, but instead banking for college. There is an anti-banking provision in Proposition 212 that applies to all recipients of universal vouchers. But lawmakers specifically worded their plan to say that any other voter-approved measure that affects those banked voucher funds for military families could be voided entirely if Proposition 145 is passed, not just the sections dealing with those banked funds. Put another way, voter approval of Proposition 145 crafted as a constitutional amendment would override voter approval of Proposition 212, and that's what Mays wants to tell voters and what GOP leaders do not want on the ballot. It is within the purview of the majority of lawmakers to decide what they want to put to voters. At the same time, however, Arizona law requires the Attorney General to prepare a short description of each ballot measure, language that actually appears on the ballots themselves. It is supposed to explain the essential changes in the existing law should the measure receive a majority of votes, as well as the effect of a yes and a no vote. What Mays crafted does spell out the sweeping provision, but it also proposes to tell voters that approval of Proposition 145 would nullify all parts of any law that would sweep such funds, including unrelated provisions of those laws. Attorney Joseph Canefield, representing the GOP leaders, wants Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Joseph Kramer to strip the language from the ballot. Canefield does not dispute that Proposition 145 has provision, which says if any other measure is approved that would take away voucher funds from military family, including at the same election, it would void that other measure entirely, even the parts having nothing to do with military family. But he's telling Kramer it is wrong and illegal for Mays to tell voters about the effect on any such measure when explaining the effects of Proposition 145. Canefield said that ballot language is designed solely to explain the effect of voter approval on existing law. But he pointed out that Proposition 212 is not existing law and may not even qualify for the ballot due to challenge to the signatures. The Attorney General's supposition that a provision in Prop 145 might ultimately nullify Prop 212 is speculation and commentary which does not adequately describe changes to existing scholarship law that would occur if Prop 145 is approved by voters, Canefield told the judge. But proponents of Proposition 145 actually conceded publicly last month, even as they were adopting it in the last hours of the legislative session, that it was crafted in a way to kill all of Proposition 212, even if voters approve it. Matt Beinberg of the Pro-Voucher Goldwater Institute told lawmakers when they were debating the measure that they need to address threats to the military families. There is a current ballot measure being proposed to attack the scholarship funds and confiscate the scholarship funds of children, including military families, done willfully so, he said. This would become the law of Arizona, and any other measure that would conflict with it would be struck down. Peter Gentella, president of the Center of Arizona Policy, which also supports vouchers, also told lawmakers that if both were to pass, Proposition 212 would be void. And Senate Majority Leader John Kavanaugh said the decision to put Proposition 145 on the ballot was a direct result of the failure to reach a deal with the AEA that would have killed the voucher reform measure. That's the reason we're running this, said the Fountain Hills Republican. Mays, for her part, is defending the verbiage. The ballot language in question appropriately and accurately describes the initiative referred by the legislature as required by law, said Richie Taylor, her spokesman. It gives voters clear information needed to understand what the impact would be if it is passed. No date has been set for a hearing. This is actually the third lawsuit filed over the issue of vouchers and what will be on the ballot. At a hearing Friday, a lawyer for the Protect Education Accountability Act argued that Prop 145 itself is illegal and a vote on it should not be allowed. Attorney Nick Ansel said, in putting the protection for military families into the same take-it-or-leave-it measure with overriding Proposition 212 violates constitutional requirements that all ballot proposals deal with a single subject. And he told Judge Creamer, who's also handling that case, that combining the two issues is intentionally deceptive to voters. But Corey Langhofer, representing GOP leaders, counted that all the provisions, including the poison pill, fit within the single subject because both parts deal with education funding for kids from military families. Creamer has yet to rule on that issue. Separately, Langhofer has filed a suit on behalf of the Goldwater Institute to keep Proposition 212 off the ballot entirely. He contends many of the paid circulators used by initiative supporters were not legally qualified, some because they failed to register with the Secretary of State's office and others because they had been convicted of certain crimes. That, Langhofer said, makes the signatures they collected invalid, leaving supporters short of the 255,949 that need to be found valid to put the issue to voters. A hearing on that case is set for this week. The next front page article is titled, U.S. says it will lift bans on imports of Mexican cattle. This article was written by Tom Polensek and Kanishka Singh of Reuters. Dateline Washington, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is lifting a ban on imports of Mexican cattle that it opposed more than a year ago to keep the flesh-eating livestock pests New World screwworm. The halt of imports drove U.S. beef prices to record highs, hurting consumers and putting pressure on President Donald Trump's administration to lower costs. The ban also ultimately failed to keep out the screwworm, which has moved through Central America and was detected in June on Texas farms and in New Mexico. The United States plans to resume importing Mexican cattle at a port of entry in Douglas in 30 days, and then eventually open additional ports of entry in New Mexico, the USDA said in a statement Friday, adding it is now safe to start the reopening. The USDA said it would open southern cattle ports in phases, adding that the phased reopening was contingent on Mexico's adherence to a plan to control the screwworm. Screwworms are parasitic flies whose females lay eggs in open wounds and mucous membranes on any warm-blooded animal. Once the eggs hatch, thousands of screwworm larvae use their sharp mouths to burrow through living flesh, eventually killing their hosts if left untreated. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum said she had instructed local authorities to expedite preparations for the resumption of livestock exports to the United States. Exports are due to resume in the last weeks of August, she said on social media. In Texas, the United States' biggest cattle-producing state, closing the border has forced the $100 billion of U.S. beef industry to contract. Texas Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller praised the Trump administration's decision to allow a limited resumption of cattle importation from Mexico, but voiced continued concern about the ongoing disruption to the U.S. cattle industry due to the screwworm. Resuming military importation from Mexico is the right move for ranchers and American consumers, but it's a decision that should have been made sooner. While I'm pleased to see this important trade relationship restored, the prolonged closure has already taken a toll on producers, disrupted supply chains, and created uncertainty that could have lasting consequences for the cattle industry, Miller said in a statement. But Miller said the USDA current approach to the screwworm threat has not gone far enough. While there have been important steps in the right direction, the pace and scale of the screwworm response have not matched the threat, Miller said. Meat Institute President and CEO Juliana Potts said, the industry group supports a careful, phased reopening of the border that reflects both vigilance and confidence in our response plans. Importing cattle from Mexico allows beef packers to better meet consumer demand given the tight supply of U.S. cattle, Potts said. Resuming imports will increase risks for more U.S. infestations, added Bill Bullard, CEO of the cattle producers group RCAF USA. As long as the border is open, it will incentivize the northward movement of cattle from southern Mexico, where the pest is endemic, to the United States, Bullard said. U.S. beef prices at record highs this year as domestic cattle supplies dropped to a 75-year low because of the import ban and drought conditions that drove American producers to slash their herds. Tight supplies raised cattle costs for meat packers, including Tyson Food, TSN, which closed a massive processing plant in Nebraska this year. Rival JPS also said it will close a Pennsylvania beef plant. The Texas Cattle Feeders Association, which represents the cattle feeding industry in Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico, said the United States can resume imports safely with the correct protocols in place. We think the science supports it, said Josh Weingartner, the Association Director of Government Relations. He added that the halt had given the USDA time to work on its protocols and response to screwworm. Ports of entry in Arizona and New Mexico are farther away from screwworm infestations in Mexico, and resuming imports into those locations is considered less risky than restarting imports into Texas, according to livestock traders. The next front page article of the Arizona Daily Star is titled, Conservancy Saves Spring. This article was written by Henry Breen of the Arizona Daily Star. A spring-fed oasis for endangering fish and other wildlife on the eastern side of the Santa Rita Mountains is now under the protection of an international conservation group. The Nature Conservancy has acquired Cottonwood Spring and the 218 acres surrounding it along Arizona Highway 82 between Sonoyta and Patagonia. The high-flowing warm spring near the headwaters of Sonoyta Spring is the home to the endangered Gila, top minnow, and other federally protected species, including the Chiricahua leopard frog, the southwestern willow flycatcher, and a wetland plant called the Huachicua water humble. Protecting Cottonwood Springs means this rare water source will continue to sustain the wildlife that depend on it, said Jody Norris, Protection Program Director for the Nature Conservancy in Arizona. It is a huge conservation win with many partners to thank. The global nonprofit based in Arlington, Virginia, purchased the property from a private owner who previously leased it out for cattle grazing. The sale price was not disclosed. Conservancy spokeswoman Lena Ruex said the group acquired the land early last month at its appraised fair market value. The transaction was paid for with grant money from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and a U.S. Army program that helps protect sensitive ecological sites near military installations, in this case, Fort Huachuca. The Gila top minnow is a 1 to 2 inch long guppy-like spring fish native to the Greater Gila River watershed in Arizona and New Mexico, but found only in isolated locations with perennial water, including Sabino Canyon, Senega Creek, Sonoyta Creek, and the lower Santa Cruz River in southern Arizona. The small silver and bronze fish was one of the first 78 species included when the endangered species list was created in 1967. Aaron Mortek is manager of the Patagonia Sonoyta Creek Preserve, the Nature Conservancy's 865-acre riparian park along the creek just outside of the town of Patagonia. He will also oversee planning and restoration at the Cottonwood Spring property. The spring and the stream it creates are one of the few remaining year-round water sources that support healthy and stable populations of Gila top minnow in Arizona, Mrotek said. Protecting this area is essential to giving this species a fighting chance to survive. The land also includes a portion of an important wildlife corridor animals use to move through the Canelo Hills and between the Santa Ritas and the Patagonia Mountains. The threats to Cottonwood Springs are similar to those facing other desert water sources, namely nearby water development, climate change, and unchecked spread of invasive species. Rotec said water daylights from the spring at about 60 gallons per minute and almost 80 degrees Fahrenheit, producing a stream and wetland roughly the length of a football field beneath a canopy of willow and cottonwood trees. Isotope analysis indicates the flow was largely influenced by the runoff from the Santa Ritas, he said. So no impacts to the spring are anticipated as a result of groundwater pumping for the Hermosa Critical Minerals Mine, now in development in the Patagonia Mountains. There are no longer any cattle on the property, but Rotec said recent grazing there was done responsibly to avoid significant damage to the spring and wetland. Even so, he said, the first step in managing the area for conservation will be to let it rest for at least a year to see what it looks like without livestock present. A full biological inventory will also be conducted before any restoration plans are developed. Rotec expects the vegetation portion of the inventory to include at least a few surprises. I think we're likely to find some rare or unique species there, he said. For the time being, access to the property is by permission only, but Rotec said he's hopeful that some sort of public interface will be developed at the spring someday. The next item from the front page is titled Strange Milky Way Planetary System Puzzles Scientists. This article was written by Will Dunham of Reuters. Dateline Washington. Scientists are documenting a planetary system in the Milky Way galaxy that is so starkly dissimilar to our own solar system that they are struggling to find the proper terminology to describe it. The system includes a red dwarf star about 40% of the mass of our sun and is orbited by a brown dwarf, a celestial body that blurs the line between planet and star. The brown dwarf, in turn, is orbited by a gaseous Jupiter-sized world newly discovered using the European Southern Observatory Chile-based Very Large Telescope. Using our solar system as a definitional frame of reference, a body that orbits another body that orbits a star should be called a moon, or in this case, an exomoon, because it is beyond our solar system. But the object that orbits the brown dwarf is unlike any of the many moons in our solar system, all of which are relatively small, rocky or icy worlds in terms of composition and size. So what should we call it? This will certainly be a matter of debate. In general, most astronomers are fine with the term exosatellite, at least as a placeholder until we formally adopt definitions for objects like the one we found, said Kevin Hoy, a doctoral student in astrophysics at Universidad Diego Portales in Chile, also affiliated with the ExoMoon Research Group, YEMS, lead author of the study published in the journal Nature. We're really hitting the limits on how far we can stretch the words we invent to describe the solar system to describe other systems in this case, Hoy said. The system is about 71 light years away from Earth. A light year is a distance a light travels in a year, 5.9 trillion miles. The exosatellite possesses at least 90% of the mass of Jupiter, the gas giant that is our solar system's largest planet. It completes an orbit of the brown dwarf every 170 days at a distance about a fifth of that separating Earth and the Sun. I think this discovery has opened a Pandora's box for the scientific community. This type of object is completely new and unusual, truly different from what we are familiar with in our solar system. Now, we will have to understand through theoretical models how these kinds of objects form and whether they are common or not, said study co-author Arlie Zurlo, a Universidad Diego Portales astrophysicist and YEMS director. We deliberately chose not to call it a moon. That's because this object is unlike any moon in our solar system. It's much more massive, and it doesn't orbit a planet. It orbits a brown dwarf. an object that's somewhere between a planet and a star. Since we've never seen a system quite like this before, we're still figuring out the best way to describe it, Zerlo said. While more than 6,300 exoplanets, as planets outside our solar system are known, have been discovered, finding exomoons has proven more challenging with only a few good candidates identified. The researchers are trying to figure out the origins of the exosatellite. It may have formed from the disk of gas and dust around the brown dwarf, just as planets form around the stars. Or it may have been captured gravitationally by the brown dwarf later on, Zerlo said. A brown dwarf is neither a star nor a planet, but something in between. They could be considered aspiring stars that during their formative stages did not reach the mass necessary to ignite nuclear fusion at their core like a star. But they are more massive than the biggest planets. The one in this system is about 33 times more massive, 50% larger in size, and much hotter than Jupiter. Because the system is very young, the brown dwarf is still shining with the heat left from its formation, Zerlo said. Since the first detection of exoplanets in the 1990s, scientists have spotted a wide variety of planetary systems, some built much like our own and others quite different. The one examined in the new research is an outlier. Yep, this system is definitely weird. There was likely a pretty chaotic dynamical history that left it in its current state, but it's really hard to tell exactly what kind of chaos it went through, Hoy said. The next front page article item is titled, Many Americans Against Trump's DC Projects. This article was written by Mike Stinson of USA Today Network. President Donald Trump has spent much of his second term remaking iconic parts of Washington, D.C., from the White House grounds to the National Mall, as he seeks to leave his mark on the nation's capital. The projects have ranged from renovations and new construction to sweeping redesigns of some of the Capitol's best-known public spaces. But many Americans aren't on board with those changes, according to a poll published Thursday by the Washington Post. Here's what the poll found about Trump's efforts to reshape the national capital. The Post polled 2,600 adults from across the country, and 65% said they were either upset or dissatisfied with the projects, which include construction of a White House ballroom, back-to-back remodels of the Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool, and a 250-foot arch. Only 32% of people polled were enthusiastic or satisfied with the projects, including the ballroom, a project that has soared to $600 million with taxpayers on the hook for more than half of the cost. The ballroom is being built under the no-bid contract just as the reflecting pool is. The project has also risen in price, $16 million for the first transformation before it was drained for a second round of renovations. The plan to build a 250-foot arch between the Lincoln Memorial and Arlington National Cemetery has drawn overwhelming public opposition, with more than 99% of comments submitted to the National Capital Planning Commission criticizing the project, according to an analysis by USA Today. Trump has repeatedly said the projects are part of a push to make Washington beautiful again, but only 26% of people polled believe those are his true motives. More than half, 51%, say Trump has a different goal with the transformations, and 22% aren't sure. Asked by the Post what his motives for the projects are, 42% said they are for Trump to glorify himself, and 22% said they are the president's way of leaving a mark. Now we'll pause to remind you that you are listening to a broadcast reading of the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shannon, and I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, from the broadcast info and audio link. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device. And now we'll turn the page to the Tucson and Region section of the Arizona Daily Star for several important and informative articles there. The title of the first article is Election Package Stays on Ballot. This article was written by Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services, Dateline Phoenix. Arizona voters can be asked to decide on a series of changes in state election laws in a take-it-or-leave-it ballot measure, a Maricopa County Superior Court has concluded. In a new ruling, Judge Adele Pons acknowledged claims by Tempe City Councilman Randy Keating that Proposition 144, put on the November ballot by Republican lawmakers, has multiple provisions. These range from enshrining in the Arizona Constitution that only citizens can vote, something already in state law, to restrictions on spending by foreign nationals to influence elections, as well as setting up new procedures for tallying ballots at each polling place versus bringing them to a central location. And it would require all voters to show identification when casting a ballot, even those who vote by mail. Keating told the judge the Arizona Constitution requires that voters should be allowed to consider each of these proposals separately. The key, he said, are court rulings which say that the Constitution itself requires that provisions and proposed amendments be sufficiently related to a common purpose or principle that can be said to constitute a consistent and workable whole on the general topic embraced. By contrast, Keating said, what is being presented to voters deals with far-flung areas of the law, including voter qualifications, identification requirements, ballot tabulation, language giving lawmakers additional legal latitude in passing future election laws, and, perhaps most perplexingly, campaign finance. But Pons said it is not clear or simple. She said the first test is whether all the elements of the proposed constitutional amendments are topically related. And Pons said everything in the measure fits within that legal box. Each aims to improve election integrity, the judge said. The fact that the proposed amendment provisions address different aspects of election security does not prevent them from being topically related. That, however, isn't the sole deciding factor. Pons said there also is a requirement that the parts of a ballot measure are sufficiently interrelated, and here too, she said, that what's in the package fits. They each directly address some aspect of election integrity, whether through requiring citizenship for voter registration, eligibility, and financial influence requiring government-issued identification prior to voting, providing the opportunity for ballot tabulation at the polls, or affirming the authority of the legislature to pass laws related to timely, accurate, efficient, or secure elections that promotes public confidence, the judge said. And she said the fact that removing one provision wouldn't affect the rest is legally irrelevant to whether they can be offered in a single package to voters. An appeal to the Arizona Supreme Court already has been filed. Keating said the issue is about more than just a number of different changes that Proposition 144 would make in election law. He said the package is designed to deceive. For example, he cited the provision in the ballot measure about having to be a citizen to vote in state elections. That, said Keating, already is a state law, having been approved by voters in 2004. These are things that are very clearly made to bait people into voting for a referendum in which they will then be taking away rights and privileges that they've enjoyed, he said. And one of those, he said, is the right to vote by mail. Prior to 1991, that ability was limited to those with a special reason, like a disability or being away from a home voting precinct district on election day. That year, lawmakers approved no-excuse early voting, and it has proven popular with more than 80% of the ballots cast that way. Strictly speaking, the measure by itself would not outlaw early voting. But what it does include is the requirement to vote identification before casting any ballot, whether voting in person or by any other means, but there is nothing in the measure that says how somebody voting by mail could accomplish that, leading to questions of whether that language crafted by Representative Alexander Kolodin is simply designed to kill off the practice. It wouldn't be the first effort. Kolodin, the Republican nominee of Secretary of State, filed suit 4 years ago on behalf of the Arizona Republican Party to ban voting by mail. In legal arguments, he cited a provision in the state constitution which says that that ballot measures have to be approved or rejected by voters at the polls. At the time Arizona's constitution was ratified, it was obvious to the Arizona Supreme Court that the plain meaning of the polls did not include people's homes, but rather means designate the polling places with the voting booths and the like, Culloden argued. But his bid for a ruling in his favor was rejected by the Arizona Supreme Court. Keating said if the Supreme Court refuses to toss the measure off the ballot, there will be a robust no campaign to convince voters to defeat it in November. The next article is titled Trump Looms Over Arizona AG Showdown. This article was written by Stacey Bartschinger of the Arizona Republic. The race to be Arizona's next attorney general is set after Republican Warren Peterson easily won his party's nomination to challenge sitting Democrat Chris Mays, setting up a November contest that may hinge on a name that won't even be on the ballot, Donald Trump. Mays, who squeaked out Arizona 4 years ago by just 280 votes, is hoping to hold the office for another 4 years in an environment that appears favorable to Democrats nationally. Her campaign and allies have portrayed Peterson, a longtime state lawmaker, as too extreme to be state's top cop and a Trump ally. Campaign pitches that helped her defeat the GOP four years ago. Peterson and his supporters contend Mays has weaponized the office and failed in her duty to defend state laws. They point to his lengthy experience at the state capitol as a favor that distinguishes him from Mays' prior GOP opponent. This race is about results versus extremism, Mays said. I spent 4 years fighting for Arizona families while my opponent has spent his career fighting partisan battles. He would have let the federal government illegally claw back $1.5 billion from Arizona taxpayers and called tariffs that cost Arizona family thousands of dollars a tool for positive changes, Mays said. A reference to several of the 45 cases she filed against the Trump administration in his second term. This is a tariff-loving, Trump-adoring, election-denying Republican. I don't think that's good for Arizonans, and we're going to beat them in November. Peterson has said it is Mays who is on the political fringes for taking on farmers and opposing a state law he has backed that bans transgender girls from participating in school sports. The U.S. Supreme Court recently upheld a similar law, and Peterson said that is an 80-20 issue on which Mays is in the minority. The choice is whether we're going to turn into California or whether we're going to remain the wonderful state that we are, said Peterson, who has been Arizona's Senate president for 4 years. Chris Mays' top two priorities have been radical environmentalism and political lawfare, and I want to restore order. My priorities have not changed. It's going to be a fight crime. It's going to be to fight crime, keep Arizona safe, defend the Constitution and laws, and root out fraud, waste, and corruption. As to the nearly four dozen lawsuits Mays has filed against Trump, Peterson said if he's elected, he will review them. As of now, he said, the ones I've looked at, we would be dropping. Peterson defeated Rodney Glassman, his GOP challenger, in the July 21st primary election by 13 percentage points as of voters counted and reported on July 23rd. Glassman and Peterson sparred over who was more qualified for the job, with Glassman attacking Peterson as a newbie lawyer with no courtroom experience and Peterson jabbing at Glassman was a perennial candidate who hadn't won office in multiple campaigns since he was a Democrat in 2007. Away from the Capitol, Peterson is a real estate broker who received his law degree from Arizona State University in 2023. Mays was a law professor at ASU before her 2022 election. She previously was an aide to Democratic former governor Jan Napolitano, who named her to the Arizona Corporation Commission. Mays at the time was a Republican who won re-election to the commission regulating the state's utilities from 2003 to 2010. Peterson is generally considered to be part of the right flank of the Republicans at the state capitol and has used his position and leadership to bring over 30 cases defending state laws that Mays would not. He carries the endorsement of the state's most prominent police unions, backing he hopes to use against Mays. He has blasted Mays for her comments earlier this year, invoking the state's self-defense law amid skyrocketing tensions over immigration enforcement. Peterson may not carry the general election baggage of candidates who are more closely tied to Trump. While he voted a shootout from Trump in his primary campaign, he did not get the president's formal endorsement, and conservative group Turning Point Political Arm skipped an endorsement in his primary race too. He also has 14 years of experience at the state capitol. He counts among his greatest accomplishments at the legislature bills that have reduced regulations and helped business growth, a more traditional GOP talking point that predates Trump's MAGA fiction of Republican politics. He sponsored a measure to repeal a tax municipalities charge on rentals, which Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs signed into law in 2023. Yet Mays and Democrats' effort to paint Peters as loyal to Trump's election denying are not grounded in fiction. Peters then led a Senate committee that issued subpoenas to begin the chamber's widely discredited audit of the 2020 election, presidential election in Maricopa County, an exercise that cost over $5 million, according to a 2023 analysis by the Arizona Republic. He was one of 30 lawmakers who signed a letter to then-Vice President Mike Pence in December 2020, asking Pence to delay certification of the election or give Arizona's electoral votes to then-President Donald Trump. This year, he revived the issue by publicizing his compliance with a federal subpoena, turning over audit records to Trump Departments of Justice. Peterson disputed Mary's characterization that he was an election denier. This is her obsessed with 2020, he said. And the fact that she's bringing something up from 6 years ago is making her the election denier. He said his concerns have been driven by addressing concerns that elections have not been secure. I've never said the election was stolen, but I've always said we need to get answers, he added. Mays heads into November better funded than Peterson, with $2.3 million to spend at the end of June, according to the latest state reports. Peterson had about $520,000 at the time. Both candidates are expected to receive financial help from national political groups that back Democrats or Republicans for attorney general offices across the nation. The groups have signaled early interest in Arizona's toss-up race. Warren Peterson has spent his career pushing extreme partisan politics and is a threat to the rights and fundamental freedoms of Arizonans, the Democratic Attorney General Association political director Lottie Ash said in a statement after his primary victory, foreshadowing the tone of attacks to come. May's 280-vote victory over Republican Abe Hamaday 4 years ago was smallest enough margin across the nation. And Peterson may be a stronger candidate than Hamaday in part because of his experience at the legislature. Chris Mays is the most vulnerable Democrat Attorney General incumbent, period. End of story, said Alan Piper, executive director of the Republican Attorneys General's Association. The political group spent about $3.4 million in Arizona in 2022, the records show. Trump carried Arizona in 2024 by 5.5 percentage points. The title of the next article of the Tucson and Region section is Yee Wants Race to Be About More Than Vouchers. This article was written by Ray Stern of the Arizona Republic. Kimberly Yee ran for Arizona school superintendent to harden support for the state's education voucher program, but it doesn't want it to overshadow her race against her Democratic competitor in November. It will be a factor, she said in an interview with the Arizona Republic. Other factors like a focus on math and reading will be equally important in the general election conversation as well. Yee, the Republican state treasurer for the past 8 years, soundly beat former Attorney General and incumbent Superintendent Tom Horn in the July 21st primary election, denying what would have been his fourth term in office. Before his 2022 run, Horn served two terms as superintendent from 2003 to 2011. The superintendent leads the State Department of Education and serves on all the state's education boards, including the State Board of Education, to help develop curriculum and standards. Yee was recruited to enter the race last year by State Senator Jake Hoffman, a Queen Creek Republican who chairs the hardline Arizona Freedom Caucus, after Horn proposed mild steps to reduce the level of improper and fraudulent purchases by voucher program users. Now she's got just over 3 months to convince supporters of the state's $1 billion empowerment scholarship account program that she'll protect while assuring critics she won't let users spend taxpayer money recklessly. Voters will decide not only whether Yee will get the superintendent job instead of Democrat Teresa Leiber Ruse, who won the Democratic primary election. They will also consider 3 or possibly 4 ballot measures related to the ESA program. Yee pushed back on the notion that the program is the main factor in the race. During a conversation with the Arizona Republic, Yee explained how her Back to Basics program would include a push for traditional mathematics, phonics-based instruction, and more home economics and shop classes. She also proposed a mentor program for teachers and forging a better relationship with local school boards. I am a daughter of a public school teacher, and we need to focus not only on reading instruction for these teachers, but we need to focus on teacher retention, she said. Yee campaigned on her education background. The born and raised Arizonan lived in California for several years, working as an advisor to the California governors Pete Wilson and Arnold Schwarzenegger, specializing in education policy. Her career also includes 8 years in the state legislature and the job as state senate staffer. She's a longtime supporter of President Donald Trump and is endorsed by Turning Point Action. She declined comment when asked about a racist social media post by the conservative group Chief Operating Officer Tyler Boyer, directed at Asian lawmaker. Boyer had asked Republican Representative Quang Nguyen of Prescott Valley if he could speak English. He had been the target of a racist ad by Horn supporters during the campaign. Horn fashioned his campaign as opposing diversity, inclusion, and equity programs in school. And Yee is no less of an opponent. She vehemently denies she served the DEI committee while a member of the National Association of State Treasurers, a charge Horn leveled at during her campaign. According to Yee, DEI and gender ideology in public schools remains a problem. When you ask a 5-year-old in kindergarten what her pronoun is, that is a distraction to academic classroom learning, she said. The difference between the two conservative candidates was that Horn seemed to think everything was okay. And it's not, Yee said. Referring to poor performance by schools in reading and math, mine was a carry-forward vision to the future versus everything just fine. Although leading the treasurer's office is a largely functionary duty, Republican former Governor Doug Ducey showed it can be a pathway to a higher office. Yee, 52, was a popular choice for Republican voters in 2022 when Democrats took the statewide offices of governor, attorney general, and secretary of state. Yee beat former Democratic lawmaker Martin Quezada and ended with more votes than any other competitive candidate. Horn also won his race that year, though more narrowly. Horn outspent Yee about 2-1 in this year's race, in part by loaning his campaign more than $500,000. He chalked her win to her Turning Point endorsement. I have absolutely no regrets, Horn told the Arizona Republic. That's why I put in as much money as I did. He said he was excited for his next project, and he and some partners plan to start a 7-12 grade charter school in the West Valley that commits to 50% high poverty students. We're going to prove that they can learn just as well as rich kids, Horn said. Yee considers herself one of the founders of the state's school choice movement, noting she was a prime sponsor of a 2011 bill that offered taxpayer-funded school vouchers to children with disabilities. 10 years after that bill became law, the state legislature passed a universal ESA law signed by Ducey. The program now helps pay for school tuition and educational expenses for more than 100,000 students and has a price tag of about $1 billion a year. But its reputation has been marred by examples of abuse. The state's largest teachers' union floated a ballot measure this year that will put strong guardrails against fraud in the program and cap household income for participation at $150,000. The Arizona Education Association submitted 421,451 signatures by the July 2nd deadline, more than the required 255,949. The Secretary of State's office is still evaluating the signatures' validity. The conservative Goldwater Institute filed a suit on July 20th challenging the signatures. If the Protect Education Act goes to the ballot and voters approve it, the program would be smaller and heavily regulated. Republican lawmakers countered by threatening to pass three ballot measures. One of those measures would eliminate the Protect Education Act, even if voters approve it. The other two would reduce union resources and micromanage how school districts spend the public's money, requiring at least 60% to be spent on classroom education. When a proposed deal to halt the union measure collapsed in June, Republicans passed the measures voters will soon see on the ballot. How all of this could help ye isn't clear. It's very, very messy message platform, said Doug Cole, a Republican consultant for High Ground Public Relations, adding the union initiative will be challenging to navigate for both you and Ruiz. It's challenged her already. When Yee announced last year she would run for the office, she claimed Horn did not have the authority to deny purchases like Rolex watches and other non-educational items. She later denied she meant such purchases should be allowed. A state auditor general report later showed the program was vulnerable to fraud and had allowed unauthorized purchases. Due to time constraints, we have reached the end of today's reading of the July 27th, 2026 edition of the Arizona Daily Star. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.